From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. Republican nominee Donald Trump faced a barrage of new charges from women about unwanted sexual advances, further diminishing his chances of winning the November 8 presidential elections. The Obama administration reviewed policy towards Syria yet again as Russia continued to bombard the city of Aleppo. Tensions also rose with Moscow because of other Russian actions, including hacking the emails of the U.S. Democratic Party. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia bombed a funeral in Yemen, killing 140 people. Houthi rebels retaliated by aiming missiles at U.S. ships patrolling the Red Sea. Gentlemen, we're going to start with the Trump campaign because it has reached a surreal level, I think it's fair to say, Tom. The accusations of these women coming forward, they followed a debate in which Trump said that he had bragged about his sexual assaults on women, but that it was only words, only locker room talk. And then all these women came forward.
That's exactly right, Barbara. This is the most surreal, is putting it kindly, about this election. This is my 13th presidential election, and I have never seen anything like this. But the twists and the turn about Mr. Trump's alleged sexual harassment and bragging about it, he denies all. But now you have a whole series of women coming forward. It's a little bit like the whole Bill Cosby situation where Mr. Cosby was challenged by someone in court and he said it's all untrue, and then suddenly women came forward. I mean, it's one thing to have anonymous sources saying things. It's another for someone to say, my name is Jane Smith and here is my story on the record. Yeah. And there's a whole series of these now. And I think the real problem that Trump confronts with this, setting aside the whole moral aspect of this is not the behavior that's going to endear him to college-educated white women. That's who he needs. Trump has cornered the market on white guys who never went to college.
Yeah.
He has huge margins there, but he's trailing badly among college-educated white women. And so I think what we see now is Trump unshackled.
I mean, as he put it, yes, unshackled.
Trump unshackled. I finally, the blinders have been taken off. I can do what I want to do. And now what I think we see are the politics of self-destruction. And I do not believe he can neutralize these allegations of sexual harassment, because there are too many of them now.
David, he's taken now to talking about, I mean, he's always talked about how the system is rigged, and if he loses, it's because the system is rigged. But now this global conspiracy that he's been referring to, he charges that Hillary Clinton was meeting in secret with international banks to plot the destruction of U.S. sovereignty to enrich her special interest friends and donors. I mean, where does that language come from?
So if you look at things like Charles Lindbergh in the 1940s with the America First movement, he basically, you know, at one point a great hero, a great famous pilot, but he got involved in the America First movement, which was a kind of nationalist movement to try and keep the United States out of World War II. He was very pro-Hitler, pro the Nazis. He destroyed his political career by giving a speech about the international financiers and the international Jewish conspiracy and their control on banks and on the media and on the press. I have to say, when you look at the things that Donald Trump is currently saying about a conspiracy between international finance and international media, my skin crawls, because we're back in that kind of territory. I mean, I think what's important to try and sort of to simplify this, because it must look kind of messy and dirty and confusing from the outside, because that's how it looks here in Washington. We're now much less than a month from the next presidential election. And someone in Donald Trump's position, he has two tasks, basically. He needs to try to do better with the tens of millions of Americans who voted for the Republicans in the last presidential election. So as Tom says, he's got a chunk of them. He's got the ones who are kind of working class, factory guys, white guys who didn't go to college. He's doing remarkably badly with better educated, more professional Republicans, especially women. So he needs to bring some of those unhappy Republicans with good educations. He needs to bring them home. The other thing he needs to do is to try and lower the vote of Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. So he needs to take some of the people who voted Democrat in the last presidential election for Barack Obama and make it just too unhappy and miserable for them to vote for Hillary Clinton. So he has to tear down Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. and he has to try and grow his vote. The problem that he faces right now, and the damage that he's causing to the country is pretty severe, is that he's really doing nothing to grow his vote. He's just aiming at his base. So the only thing he's really achieving now is to try and tear down Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, Tom, in the debate, he also talked about appointing a special prosecutor who would throw Hillary Clinton in jail.
Right.
Which shows a rather slim understanding of our Constitution and our separation of powers. I mean, to some people, that was even more obscene than these other allegations.
I was about to say, and you've done it for me, Barbara, the greatest obscenity of late is not the vulgarities. It is a statement like that. That's what you expect in banana republics, from tin horn dictators, or in places like Ukraine, as I recall that the former Ukrainian prime minister, when she lost, was thrown into jail for several years. That's not the way it works, but the whole notion of I'm going to send you to jail, and the other thing, it had been subsumed for a while, but now there is a new refrain at Trump rallies, which is an old refrain, which is lock her up,
yeah.
Lock her up, lock her up. And I think David is exactly right. This is designed to diminish Hillary Clinton, but I think that diminishes her basically with the 38% of the vote, which would stick with Trump even if he went on television, did a primetime speech and said, every one of these sexual allegations is true, I admit it. I mean, 38% of the country would stick with him no matter what. But 38%, even in a four-way race with some fringe candidates, is not going to be enough to win.
Yeah. Tom, there is fresh ammunition against Hillary Clinton that Trump doesn't seem to be using appropriately, and that comes from these WikiLeaks exposés of John Podesta's emails, her campaign CEO. That's not getting much traction, is it, with all the rest that's going on?
No, because there's been a phrase in American journalism for years, sex sells.
Yeah.
In this instance, the lurid quality of the discourse and all these new revelations have basically drowned out some questions that can legitimately be raised about some of the things Hillary has found to be saying on these tapes. I mean, Trump is the story right now, and his peccadilloes, or alleged peccadilloes, are taking all the oxygen out of other lines of inquiry, and I'm sure in the coming days we'll hear Trump try to go to those in the final debate. She'll have to have answers for that. But at the moment, the latest WikiLeaks dump, so to say, document dump, is not resonating.
Yeah.
Can I push back on that a little bit? Because
sure.
I wrote a long piece this week about the WikiLeaks
emails
for The Economist. So I went through quite a lot of them. There really is not anything especially scandalous. There's some stuff that's embarrassing. Mm. There's some stuff that is basically gossip. But essentially what you see is what you would expect, which is a political campaign being political. And the biggest, deepest, darkest secret is that Hillary Clinton is more moderate than she pretended to be in order to win the Democratic nomination. Mm. So when her advisors are saying to her, you know, your left-wing rival Bernie Sanders is saying that you should reinstate this law that would make life tougher for Wall Street banks, that would separate some of the different types of Wall Street banks, and this would be politically a smart thing to do, she's pushing back and saying she doesn't want to do it for policy reasons. I mean, so if you are a hard left Democrat who suspects that she's not as left wing as she's currently pretending to be, then the emails provide evidence. But frankly, you know, that comes in the, you know, water is wet, you know, the sun
yeah.
is hot,
yeah.
The Pope is Catholic kind of territory. And really, you can see, you know, the Republicans and conservatives, Donald Trump himself saying, you know, why is this not making more traction? But he has to really whip it up. So the one thing that probably is genuinely embarrassing for her is, listeners may remember, when she was trying to become the Democratic candidate, there was a question about why she had not released the speeches that she gave for very large sums of money to some big Wall Street banks in her days when she was doing speechifying for money. We now saw some of the worst things in that. Now, to be honest, they're the things The Economist magazine likes about her. She's a free trader. She wants to see, you know, a kind of Europe-style common market in the Western Hemisphere, with the Americas having kind of open borders and free movement and free trade. We think, fantastic, that's great. Donald Trump has jumped on it and said that she's proposing a world government, that she's proposing to abolish America's borders, that it's a global conspiracy by a criminal, corrupt, international globalist elite. Again, as Tom says, 38% of the country, they love that. You know, it's like, you know, steak to a dog. It's, you know, it's red meat, exactly what they want. But there really isn't a gigantic scandal yet in these WikiLeaks
emails.
Yeah,
I mean, reading them, my sense was this is what a professional campaign looks like. This is how people decide on policy, and this is how they decide on how to present it to the public. And, you know, Donald Trump should be so lucky to have a professional operation like that that would guide him instead of, 3 a.m. tweets about how attractive a woman is or not. So, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to gain traction. But, of course, there still is a little bit more time to come. And, you know, there are promises of yet more information that will come out. So I guess we can't rule it out. But Tom, it's really hard for me to imagine anything coming out at this point that is going to somehow overwhelm the impression we now have of Donald Trump as, how shall I put it, groper in chief.
Right. I don't see a dynamic out there that stands this election on end and causes millions of right-minded Americans to say, he's right about Hillary. I'm going to vote for him. It's the only chance. I think independents and moderates who don't care for her much seem to be deciding to vote for Republicans to retain the Senate as a check and balance on a President Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Almonitor. Joining me today are David Rennie of The Economist and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab at our website, voanews.com. David, one, of course, aspect of this whole WikiLeaks imbroglio is that it is coming from hacks that the U.S. government has now blamed on Russia. And this is one of now a series of issues that we have with the Russians that have led many to say that we are in a worse position, really, with Russia now than we were to some extent even during the Cold War, when there were rules of the road about these things.
Well, covering this election as a reporter, there are stories kind of every morning and every afternoon that in a normal election would sort of take a week to be discussed. But earlier in October, the Director of National Intelligence and the Department of Homeland Security issued a statement which has no precedent at all, where they said absolutely unambiguously that the Russian government is trying to influence the course of this American election by stealing emails from political organizations and individuals and releasing them. And that given the scope and the severity of what they have done, the American government says that only the most senior Russian officials could have authorized this. And on the Russian side, they haven't really denied it. They're just kind of smirking. So you have the Republican Party, the party of Ronald Reagan, the party of George Bush Senior and Junior, the party of hawks throughout the Cold War, saying essentially nothing, while Russian government intelligence services try to influence the result of an American election by stealing emails from Democratic political parties and releasing them. It is just kind of beyond, and the dismay, I would say, a lot of people in Washington feel, is seeing very serious grown-up Republican politicians essentially silent in the face of this, because something that would have shocked them to their core, except they're so frightened of that 38% who vote for Donald Trump that they know that if they speak out, they could lose their own position and their own privileges.
Not just Republicans being silent. Mr. Trump, the party's standard bearer at the last debate, said,
We don't know
that the Russians are behind this hacking, when in fact, not only has the U.S. government felt very strongly they had the evidence to charge, in effect, Russia with that, it's now pretty clear that in his national security briefing by intelligence officials of the U.S. government, Mr. Trump was told flatly that the Russians were behind the hacking. So for him to come out and say, well, we don't know this, well, he was told it by the U.S. government. So David is right. Republicans are terrified at losing their base. So when their party standard bearer says, we don't know this is to be true, the Russians, in effect, get a pass. And, of course, I think there will be U.S. government retaliation, but it's normally the kind of thing that if and when it occurs, and maybe it already has occurred, we're not going to know much about it.
Yeah, or at least not till later. Yeah, Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, denied that they were responsible. He said the hysteria is merely caused by the fact that somebody needs to divert the attention of the American people from the essence of what was exposed by the hackers. I mean, if that's not putting your thumb on the scale. And meanwhile, an ally of Putin, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, told the Reuters news agency that Trump was the only person able to de-escalate dangerous tensions between Moscow and Washington, and that by contrast, Hillary Clinton could spark World War III. So, David, it seems pretty obvious that the Russians, you know, are campaigning actively for Donald Trump to win, which is something we certainly haven't seen before. But there are other issues. I mean, again, as you mentioned, things that would normally occupy much of the debate. The Russians are continuing to bomb into oblivion the Syrian city of Aleppo, trying to create a fait accompli before the next U.S. president comes in. And, you know, Trump, again, in the debate, seems to poo-poo this and suggest, well, that's not a terrible thing.
He said he was asked about Aleppo, and he said, oh, well, it seems to me it's already fallen.
It's already fallen,
so,
yeah.
You know, let's not hear any more about it. No, we have seen extraordinary scenes where in the United Nations Security Council, we have seen figures from the American Secretary of State, John Kerry Dan, the American ambassador to the United Nations, essentially accusing the Russian government of committing war crimes and calling for the Russian government to be investigated for war crimes. So this is after months and months of, you know, frankly, quixotic diplomacy by John Kerry to try and sort of believe that Russia might be a kind of legitimate partner in Syria. No, things are unbelievably bad and unbelievably serious. It's not just Russia, too. I would say last week I was at a high-level conference with Americans, Europeans and Chinese officials and diplomats and experts, which happens every year. And the Chinese are watching this election very closely. And essentially the Chinese, you know, they don't make it clear what they think in public, but they're quite keen on a Trump presidency because they think that he wouldn't challenge them when they're building these airstrips on reefs in the South China Sea. Sure. They also think that he's quite stupid and that that might make him easier to deal with. And they don't like Hillary Clinton. They think Hillary Clinton is likely to be tough on them, is likely to worry about human rights too much. Of course, what's fascinating is that they're seemingly quite relaxed about the fact that Donald Trump, if you take him literally, is promising a trade war with China, which you might think would make them very anti-Trump, but they seem to think that he's mostly a what they would call a paper tiger.
It's fascinating, Tom. Also, I mean, there's a new and provocative use of the Russian nuclear card as well, which is really concerning. The Russians have put nuclear-capable missiles back in Kaliningrad, and they've withdrawn from an agreement with the United States to dispose of plutonium. Are they throwing their weight around in this way as well? I mean, they're talking about, you know, new military relations with Egypt, about reclaiming bases in Vietnam.
Maybe even Cuba.
What is this, Russia?
This is Vladimir Putin demanding respect. This is so much part of his mantra, and the Russians crave respect. They demand respect around the world. Putin wants to restore Russia to power. I mean, it's almost a czarist, a return to czarist tendencies where the Russians could go anywhere around the world and do whatever they wanted. And also, I think Putin, we've spoken about this before from these microphones, Putin only reacts to strength, and he doesn't see a lot of strength in the waning months of the Obama administration. And I think also the Russians and the Chinese and others understand that probably Hillary Clinton would be tougher in places like Syria than Barack Obama. It's now well known that she urged a more muscular approach to Syria and was overruled by Obama. And so I think the Chinese and the Russians and others figure, for a variety of reasons, a President Trump would be an easier mark for them.
Yeah, you're reminding me that the Russians went into Georgia in the waning months of George W. Bush's presidency in 2008. So this is likely to be a very dangerous next few months, I think, between the U.S. and Russia.
I think what's also heartbreaking is in China, the main response of the Chinese state media telling the Chinese public is, look at America and see how democracy is a disaster. Who would want that sort of chaos? Who would want something as disgusting as that? Much better to have a one-party state.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate.
So the whole world is watching what's happening here.
Yeah, I wanted to turn to Yemen because it's not a topic we talk about often, and we have, of course, criticized Russia heavily for its support for the Assad regime, Tom. But the United States has been backing the Saudis in this bombardment of Yemen that's gone on now for more than a year. Thousands killed, millions displaced, millions facing famine. And just recently, the Saudis bombed a funeral in a Yemeni capital, Sana'a, killed 140 people, injured 600. And now we've seen this extraordinary exchange in the Red Sea in the Bab el-Mandeb between the U.S. Navy and the Houthi rebels. Can you shed some light on this situation?
Well, once again, it's everybody trying to probe the United States. So there's a perception of fear or not of U.S. weakness, and I think that's what we saw off the coast of Yemen. Missiles were fired at a couple of U.S. Navy ships. One of them fired back, and these missiles were destroyed or fell harmlessly into the sea. We will probably never know exactly what happened. We do know that U.S. Navy destroyers of this type have multiple layers of anti-missile defenses. They have a closer-in missile called the Sea Sparrow, and then they have this, what for lack of a better term would be a modern-day Gatling gun, a phalanx system which fires thousands of rounds of conventional ammunition at anything that gets past a normal defense perimeter, and that was not used. The standard missile, which I think this is the first time it's ever been used in warfare, was the evasive action of choice, and we will never know whether these missiles were just so poorly made they went off course and fell harmlessly into the sea, or more likely that there were electronic countermeasures that messed up their mechanisms and destroyed them. But the bottom line is everybody's probing for American weakness, even the Houthi rebels.
Well, is it probing for American weakness or retaliating against the United States, David, for standing behind Saudi Arabia while it has been bombing Yemen back into the Stone Age?
So I think this is a classic example of the kind of the tragic gap, really, between perceptions here in Washington, D.C. and perceptions in a far corner of the world. In the region, people are convinced that America is an active player in a war in Yemen, where the Americans and the Saudis are on one side and the Iranians and their Shiite allies are on the other side, and that America is an active player.
Now, America is an active player, though. America, it's giving targeting information.
America is providing the Saudis, partly because America's relations with the Saudis are so bad at the moment, that this is a way of trying to keep in with the Saudis. Particularly, this war in Yemen is a kind of pet project of the de facto young new ruler of Saudi Arabia, the deputy crown prince. So it's hard for America to be completely unenthusiastic about it. But essentially, you have what is dangerously close to a proxy war. Certainly in the region, it's perceived as a proxy war between Iran on one side and America on the other. I don't think people here in America could find Yemen on the map. They have no idea that this is going on. They have no idea that this is the perception in the region. It's certainly not playing in the presidential campaign. I doubt Donald Trump could tell you whether Yemen was a form of ice cream or a country.
Still, it's concerning because Yemen has never been, how should we put it, a particularly well-governed place. There are big problems with Al-Qaeda affiliate. The Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is based in Yemen. And as much as the Saudi ire is directed against the Houthis, they're opening up Yemen for even more power for the Al-Qaeda affiliate in that country.
Right. Yeah.
The Houthis, the United States actually had an intelligence relationship with the Houthis before this crisis began and was working with them at least indirectly against Al-Qaeda. So the United States has now made a potent new enemy in that part of the world.
Exactly right. I mean, I think for a lot of reasons the U.S. had no recourse other than to act decisively, especially in the middle of a presidential campaign. You cannot turn the other cheek to what were clearly attempted attacks on U.S. Warships. Well, outside of the 12-mile limit, they were international waters. But you're right, nothing is easy anymore, and this is going to make Yemen a less safe place, not a more safe place, and it will complicate America's situation in that part of the world.
That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for El Monitor. Thanks for listening.